Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Fieldwork is a podcast that features conversations about sustainable agriculture. It's hosted by two young commercial row crop farmers, one in Iowa and one in Minnesota. Over the last 2 years, they've explored dozens of topics in agriculture, and they've just launched their third season. They're going to spend the next few episodes focusing on conservation practices and a unique farming culture in Washington County, Iowa. Later this hour, I'll talk with one of the people who was instrumental in shaping that culture. His name is Jim Freer, and he's retired from Iowa State University Extension. But first, let's meet the hosts of Fieldwork. Mitchell Hora farms in Washington County. His family has been farming in the area for over 100 years. He also runs a consulting company called Continuum Ag when he is not podcasting. Hello, Mitchell.
Hey, how are we doing? It's great to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Also with us is Zach Johnson. He is a fifth-generation family farmer in Minnesota. He is well-known as the Minnesota Millennial Farmer and has a large following on YouTube. Zach, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with a little bit of background on the podcast. Mitchell, how did the two of you connect?
Yeah, so the folks at Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media were the ones that brought Zach and I together. They found me while I was speaking at a Iowa Public Radio event, actually, where we were in Iowa City talking about water quality at a Water Quality on Tap event. So they found me at that, and they found Zach due to his YouTube exposure, brought us together, and now they keep bringing us around, I suppose, for more seasons.
Well, and let's hear that from your perspective too, Zach. You had been making these YouTube videos, and what was your goal when you started doing that as the millennial farmer?
Well, the goal always was from the beginning, and I always has been, always will be, to connect with consumers about what goes on the farm. You know, I was seeing a lot of stuff on social media and in real life from people who are in the rural areas and should have some connection to agriculture. And I was hearing stuff about what we were doing on the farms that maybe if it was true, it had a hint of truth to it, but they didn't fully understand why we use the management practices we use. And what I wanted to do was kind of correct and tell the whole truth and the whole story behind things like, you know, GMOs and drain tile and why we do some of the stuff that we do out on the family farms.
So with the millennial farmer, you're reaching out to non-farmers, people who really don't understand agriculture. Is that the idea?
That's the idea, yeah. And as I've gone on here, I found that I connect with a lot of farmers too. It's actually pretty close to about 50-50 people who are connected to agriculture already versus people who are not. But, you know, you look at that and look at the views that we're getting and the people that are coming up, and there's so many farmers on social media now. And it's just, I think it's fantastic to see all that information being put out there and people being fully transparent and a way for the average consumer who otherwise wouldn't have a connection to farmers to be able to log in and see what goes on in the farms here in America.
Well, and Mitchell, Fieldwork feels like a podcast for farmers. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, no, our whole mantra is it's by farmers, for farmers, really trying to help the ag community to continue to move forward when it comes to implementing sustainable ag. But a key thing that we really try to stress is that there's no one size fits all, and it's not all rainbows and butterflies. As you're changing things on the farm, like reducing tillage or adding cover crops, there's a lot of potential issues that grower needs to overcome. And we just try to help to connect them with resources and ideas about how they can be successful if they want to adopt new practices on the farm.
Well, and I'm very happy that we do have a number of farmers in our audience today. I know that because I hear from a number of people who listen regularly who are farmers. But of course, we have a lot of non-farmers in the audience today as well. So let's get some basic terms clear here. And Mitchell, I'll start with you. When you say sustainable agriculture, I think a lot of people in the general public don't really know what that means. Can you tell me, in sort of general terms, what you mean when you say sustainable agriculture?
Yeah, and there's a lot of different buzzwords around that. So we talk about sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture, improving soil health in these systems. To me, it's just about continuing to improve the soil and continue to improve our family farms. We really want to focus on reducing disturbance in the soil, keeping living roots on the soil, and now we're using these cover crops and stuff. We want to be able to really emulate nature, keep that soil covered, keep living roots at all times, really stimulate that natural soil that we have and that we're so, you know, grateful to have here as farmers around the Midwest. So, but what the key thing though too is we need to be more transparent in our farming systems, that the consumer wants to know where their food is coming from, and they want to see more of the data about that farming operation. And the brand around sustainable agriculture is really being used to help to drive more of that protection of the soil, protection of our natural resources.
Well, and when you say sustainable agriculture, that doesn't necessarily imply organic agriculture, right?
That's correct. So definitely different. Organic agriculture really is, you know, it does not utilize GMOs, it does not utilize synthetic fertilizer, does not utilize chemicals like pesticides and such. But in regenerative or sustainable agriculture, it really focuses on the soil and on working with Mother Nature, working with the biology in the soil. But farmers in a regenerative system or sustainable system, they can still utilize pesticides and fertility and genetically enhanced crops. There is, though, a combination of the two called regenerative organic, and that is where you can actually combine together the organic system and not utilize pesticides, plus utilize a no-till cover crop system, because oftentimes in an organic situation, in order to control weeds, growers will utilize tillage. And then in regenerative, number one is don't use tillage, but getting to the being able to combine the two is really quite the feat. Not that many people have been able to figure it out, but it just depends on which one you're really going to focus on. But we really stress, I suppose, you know, focusing on improving water quality, improving the soil, and starting at that point when implementing on the farm.
Well, and let's do just a little more clarifying. Zach, you can help me out with this. When I introduced you, I said that you're both commercial row crop farmers. So when I say that, that means that you grow corn and soybeans and that you make a living or try to make a living doing it. I think when some people hear commercial row crop farmers, they make some assumptions. Do you want to try to explain what that means?
Well, I think that's accurate. You know, we are, I would say that we are both commercial row crop farmers, meaning that it is, at least for my family, this is the full-time gig, the full-time job. Now we have side income and stuff that we do off of that. We have side jobs, but you know, farming really is the bread and butter of what we do. It's what my family's done for over 150 years now. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, when you use the words like a commercial row crop farmer, as you said, people might have a picture of what that means in their head. And one of the big things that I like to stress is, you know, just because farming looks differently than it did 100 years ago, or it looks differently than maybe the picture you have in your head with the farmer on the cabless tractor wearing a straw hat, it might look different than that, but we are the same families out here doing what we've always loved to do. My family has been on this same farm since 1868 when they came over from Sweden. I'm now the sixth generation, raising potentially the seventh generation right here on the farm. So we really are.
No pressure, kids, though, right?
Yeah, right. No pressure at all. So that kind of goes back to the sustainability thing, too, is that, you know, we are the sixth generation currently. So, you know, we've been pretty sustainable for 150 years. And I certainly hope that the education that comes along with trying to always do the best thing for the farms and for the environment, for the consumers, I hope that sustainability continues to increase with that. You know, we're always trying to do better like any other industry. And to get back to the original point there, just because we look different and we have, you know, large machinery and big fields and grain bins, and from the outside things may look different, but we still are, you know, the same proud family farms that we've always been.
Well, and I think that again, you were mentioning earlier how a lot of people who don't have a connection with farming don't really understand how it works. So I do think that when people drive down the highway or drive down a county road and they see somebody in one of those giant combines harvesting the corn or, you know, spraying the beans or doing something like that, they make a lot of assumptions. And just because you are growing row crops doesn't mean that all farms are operating in the same way. That's what I'm trying to get to with drilling down on this a little bit. When I say you are a commercial row crop farmer, that doesn't tell me all that much about your operation, right, Zach?
That's right. Yeah, every farm is so different. And when you really take a look from the inside out, you know, farms are like everybody else. You know, you can live in the suburb and you can look down that row of houses and it's easy to assume that people's lives are the same. But when you get inside there, you realize everybody's different in their own way, and farms are no different than that. It's just like that when it comes to farming.
Well, in this series, this mini series that you're doing in season 3 of Fieldwork is really looking at conservation practices in agriculture in Washington County. And Mitchell, we're going to dig into that with you in just a moment. But Zach, give us a little bit of your background, because the kinds of conservation practices that you're focusing on in this series are not necessarily ones that you've used a lot on your farm, right?
No, definitely not. And I think that was part of the draw when, you know, NPR kind of came to me and asked if I wanted to host this with Mitchell. They already had him picked out. They had their guy down in Iowa there that's got all the experience with this kind of stuff, with regenerative practices and implementing, you know, really the soil health data and the water quality and stuff like that. And then they found me, and our farm is very different. We're, you know, a lot farther north. We've got heavy, heavy black soils. We're not quite in the Red River Valley, but we are out here where the soil is very sticky. It's very high magnesium, high calcium stuff. If there's any moisture in it at all, your boots will be 100 pounds each by the time you take a few steps in it. And it's important. It's critical for us to get planting as early as we can in the spring. And one of the things that helps us be able to do that is with tillage. So we are all conventional tillage. We have tried cover crops now 4 or 5 times. We've never had any success with them. I have learned a lot through hosting this show. So we've got another experiment going now that I hope will really pay off here in a little bit. And hopefully we can implement some of that into our planting practices.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Zach Johnson and Mitchell Hora. They are the hosts of the podcast Fieldwork. It features conversations about sustainable agriculture. They've just launched their 3rd season, and they'll be doing a mini series on a unique conservation culture among farmers in Washington County. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the podcast Fieldwork, which just launched its 3rd season. It features conversations about sustainable agriculture. And in season 3, they're doing a mini series focusing on the unique conservation culture of Washington County agriculture. And with me are the hosts of the series, Mitchell Hora Farms in Washington County. His family's been farming in the area for over 100 years. Zach Johnson is you said 6th generation. I had 5th generation farmer, Zach, 6th generation family farmer in Minnesota. He's also well known as the Minnesota Millennial Farmer. And before the break, I asked Zach to describe a little bit about how his family operation works and his familiarity with conservation practices. Mitchell, tell me a little bit about the farm that's in your family and your familiarity with these practices.
Yeah, so I'm 7th generation on my family's farm here. I think we're right around that 150-year mark now as well, down in Washington County. And, you know, we've been able to have a lot of success in implementing no-till and implementing cover crops. My dad and grandpa actually started experimenting with no-tilling corn in 1978, and we've been 100% no-till soybeans since 1986. So really a long focus on that. And now we're going into our sixth year of really pushing on the cover crops. And we've been trying all kinds of crazy stuff. But yeah, Washington County is a really interesting place that there was a lot of other people that were utilizing no-till and really trying to learn in the 70s and early 80s. So when my family and you know, my dad and grandpa were really trying to learn about it, they weren't the only ones. There was lots of other people in this area that were pushing, and a lot of people down here that have been no-till for multiple decades, just like us.
Well, and as far as cover crops go, Washington County is really a hot spot for cover crops as well, right?
Yeah, I think somewhere close to, like, I want to say we're like 3x the number of cover crop acres here in Washington County versus any of the other counties in Iowa. Just a lot of farmers that have been pushing on it. And there's farmers here that have been using cover crops for over 20 years. So really a lot of those key innovators that we can learn from, that we can see how did they overcome some of the hurdles when it comes to implementing cover crops. A lot of good focus around some conservation programs at the state and federal level. We've got a watershed project here in the county that was really kind of one of the first ones that really took off here in the state. But just a lot of farmers, I think, that want to learn and want to work together and want to be transparent to bring everybody along and help everybody to be successful.
Did you have some sort of epiphany? I mean, this is where you grew up. This is where you farmed. Did you have some sort of epiphany where you realized how unique Washington County is?
Yeah, I never really thought about it that much before, but definitely, you know, you kind of get that epiphany when you're driving around and just seeing different parts of the country, different parts of the state even. But we find that there's a couple different really key leading counties that kind of have a brand built around them too. So I think of like Coffee County in Tennessee or Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, that there's some really key geographies, and I suppose they just brand themselves around the county. But when I talk about Washington County and farming in Washington County, there's a lot of farmers in this area that are well known for their conservation efforts. A lot of farmers that have been winning, you know, the state yield contests for multiple decades, farmers that have won national awards and such. So a really unique place of innovation and conservation, but focusing on building companies and trying to continue to improve these family operations.
Well, and I want to play just a clip from the first episode from this mini series, which has aired now or is available on your podcast. It's Twilight in Washington County. And coming up in a few minutes, we're actually I will be talking with the man that we'll hear from in this clip. But it's a conversation with Jim Freer, who was the extension director for Iowa State University Extension, the county director in Washington County for more than three decades. And he's been retired for quite a while now. But he was a real visionary and a big part of this early push for no-till farming and cover crops in Washington County. Let's hear a little bit from the conversation.
And the title of the article that I wrote, three-page article, and was featured in that special edition, that the title of it was Conventional Tillage Systems, Are They Out of Date?
Oh, my gosh. Hold on.
So before all of this happened, I had some questions whether this is going to take place.
In 1965,
Soil Conservation Service annual report.
Wow.
In the county. I was a little bit ahead of my time in thinking about tillage there when I wrote that article.
I figure some places they'd just run you straight out of town. But.
Did you have any articles in the 60s talking about the internet?
Okay, that was just a clip from the episode Twilight in Washington County from the podcast Fieldwork. You heard both Mitchell Hora and Zach Johnson a little bit in that clip, along with Jim Freer of Washington County. And Jim and I are going to talk for about 20 minutes, so we don't need to talk a whole lot about Jim's background and the role he played in this. But Mitchell, again, in discovering really how unusual Washington County is, there was a real confluence of people who were very concerned about the environmental impact of agriculture, but also willing to take risks. And you earlier said, yeah, we've been doing these crazy things. And we just heard Zach say people would have run you out of town for saying that in some places. And there is a lot of risk involved in changing the way that you farm. Mitchell, can you help put that in perspective for people who are not familiar with agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, as you're looking at changing your system, it's really a paradigm shift. Your operation is set up with the equipment and the expertise around what you're good at and around what you do and around what you're used to and kind of what your comfort zone is. So you have to, if you're going to reduce tillage or add cover crop, a lot of farmers need to adjust their planter. They might need to adjust their fertility program, their herbicide program, adjust what their vision for their farm of what they think it should look like. So really amazing to see, you know, a guy like Jim that had this vision for a different way of farming so long ago, 1965. That was just amazing. And you could hear our reaction to it in that clip. And also, I think, hear how much fun we have on the podcast, too. I thought that was really great. But being able to see, okay, we identified that there we need to continue to move forward. We identify we need to move forward, we need to do better. Here's some items that can be implemented, but every farm is different. Every farm needs to take a look at how could they just be 10% better on a year by year basis? How can they just implement, continue to move the needle, make baby steps, and everybody can continue to do better to improve water quality, to improve our carbon footprint, to improve the quality of product that we're putting into the marketplace. It's not one size fits all. Not every farm is gonna be no-till and cover crops and do these things. That is not realistic. But every farm can look at an opportunity to continue to do better on their own operation within the constraints of where they're at, their geography, and the equipment and stuff too.
Well, and so. Zach, so far, the decision to use more conservation practices has primarily been with the individual farmer. And of course, as I said, there's risk that's involved in embracing these different practices. And farms are businesses. So for most farmers, there has to be not just an environmental payoff, but a monetary payoff to these practices. Now, it seems to be working in Washington County. From your perspective, why isn't this spreading more quickly? I mean, we're talking about pioneers in the 1960s, but it's still not the majority of farmers today.
I think there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, I think like the biggest thing, if I think about it personally for us on our farm, number one would be, you know, Dad tried cutting tillage from the program in the late 80s, early 90s. He tried a few times and it failed him miserably, cost him a lot of money. And that was at a time when farmers didn't have a lot of money. And so he's kind of got that picture in his head that, you know, this really burned him. He had high hopes for it and it burned him. And he wasn't excited to try to get back to that and really try to figure out how to make it work. On top of that, all the neighbors pretty much tried the same thing around the same time and everybody got burned. So that's the mentality there. And, you know, I hate to, I'm not going to say that they aren't right, that that Dad wasn't right or that the farmers around us weren't right. I guess the way I say it is that maybe I would like to try to learn my own hard lesson. You know, maybe we have a better understanding of how the soil works. Maybe we've got better seed. Maybe we have better machinery to help us do it correctly, because the machinery that we've got, or at least had, was all made to work with conventional tillage and conventional farming, I guess, or for lack of a better term, what we're talking about here, conventional farming. And if you've got machinery now and a better understanding of how that soil works and what we need to do differently to make that system work as a system, you know, maybe we can do better now. And a big other piece to that puzzle, I think, is the fact that if you talk to the no-till farmers, they will all say that it takes time. The soil's been broken down by tillage and it works a certain way because of that. And if you quit tilling your soil, there is going to be a little bit of a lag there for the soil to catch up to the system that you have now introduced it to. So you literally have to give your soil some time to change its biology and to change the way the soil structure actually is. Time is difficult. We all have X amount of time. And if you're not making money for a few years because you're trying to introduce this system, that's a difficult thing. That's typically not something that most farmers are able to do. You know, we can't just take a big hit for 3, 5, 8 years before it starts working. And that's if it starts working. So I think that's the biggest thing there, is that risk of how much money can I spend on different machinery to try this? And then how much can I lose in the meantime? And then what if it doesn't work? And that's really what it comes down to. Because as you said before, this is a business. It's how we feed our families. It's our livelihood. We need to make sure that we're making the correct decisions for our operations individually.
Now, I've got a flood of emails coming in here that are all pretty much along the same line. So I'm going to read this one from Dirk. And Mitchell, I'd love to have you respond to it first. He says, I hope in your discussion of sustainable farming that you won't frame this in terms of the choices of individual farmers or even collectives without discussing the massive impacts of government policies and funding, as well as related market pressures that makes this such a David versus Goliath fight and keeps our state in the grips of big agriculture. And this is a big part of the conversation. So far, this has been a voluntary thing. Farmers have been driven to try it and make these decisions on their own. Mitchell, what's your response to that?
Yeah, no, I think there's a ton of truth to the comment there, and really like the perspective on it, in that, you know, the entire system that we're in here today was built out of a lot of, more so even, the consumer demand and out of government programs that we feel very comfortable in the system that we're in. And as American farmers, we're extremely good at producing corn and soybeans and our other commodities very price competitive and very sustainably on a production purpose year over year. We're really good at it. Now, there are, you know, a lot of other places around the world where they're catching up. They're getting to be really good at it too. They have the same type of technology and equipment and know-how that we have. And the internet really, of course, helps to fuel that even further. And a lot of our farming programs, yeah, they have constraints around them. And in order to participate in these programs, as farmers, we have to stay within the constraints. We have to stay within the rules of the way that they are written. But the government, the risk mitigation agency that a lot of the insurance programs are built around, they really are trying to learn. I'm seeing a lot of progress being made, you know, talking with some of our local Iowa elected officials, you know, on continuing to drive this conversation forward. I really think they want to learn. I really think they are seeing that agriculture and the policies around it can be utilized to ensure that the family farmer is not just there solely to feed the world and provide fuel and fiber for the world, but that we can also be part of other solutions as well. Solutions when it comes to carbon and comes to water quality and reducing flooding and feeding healthier crops to the world. So really cool to see now a shift away from the last multiple decades of farming, where we've really focused only on maximum production, to now we're able to focus on still continuing to drive production, but do it in a manner that's more holistically sustainable.
I know a lot of people listening are thinking, this is not fast enough. We know what the big problems are. We know about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We know about water quality in Iowa. And this is a crisis. This is not happening fast enough. And that creates a real us versus them kind of mentality. I know that can be really frustrating and difficult for farmers. But Zach, it's not happening very fast. What do you think could create some urgency?
You know, I think it's probably happening faster than people outside of agriculture realize. I think there is a lot going on the front when it comes to changing some of these practices. And I know every farmer that I know is well aware of what we're doing with fertilizers and chemicals and seed and tillage. And it is out there. It is being talked about. There are changes being made. Just around me, I would say tillage has been quickly reduced just over the last few years. And people are looking at different machinery. We're still using tillage, but there's a lot less deep tillage being used. We're not using moldboard plows anymore. Chisel plows are starting to go away. We are trading in the deep rippers now for vertical tillage tools. And the thing that they need to remember is, as I said before, we are still family farms out here. There isn't, you know, it isn't easy to write a check for a tillage tool for $50,000 and hope that it works, because if it doesn't work, you're going to lose a lot more than just that $50,000 you paid for that tillage tool. And now you have a $50,000 tool sitting on the farm that you can't give away because nobody in the area wants it because they saw that it didn't work for you. So I guess I would say that there is actually a lot happening there. If you want to bring it back to, you know, the previous question with involving government, there is stuff starting to happen there. The wheels are moving on that. You know, that stuff always takes time. We can't flip a switch and overnight change our farming practices. We have, you know, the most efficient and the most affordable and the safest food system in the history of planet Earth. We can't just flip a switch and change that overnight, but we are making changes to do better.
We've only got about a minute here before we're going to switch gears, and I'm going to talk to Jim Freer. But Mitchell, why don't you give us just a brief preview of some of the topics you'll be exploring in Washington County over the next episodes and the things people can learn from them.
Yeah, no, and Zach had some really great points up there too, and this has been a great talk, but you know, the conversations going forward here, really looking at how do we help farmers to overcome change in practices that this should not be done via policy. This should not, by overreaching policy is what I mean by that. It should not be done by one size fits all policy. We need to allow farmers to be able to control their logistic and economic risks when it comes to change. So we're going to talk a lot about farmers that took a lot of risk. We're going to interview them. We're going to look at how did they learn and how did they learn over multiple decades, and they still are continuing to learn every day. Talk about farm financing and talk a lot about policy. There's some really interesting things happening when it comes to carbon markets. And
we do have to say goodbye, but Mitchell Hora and Zach Johnson, the podcast is Fieldwork.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight. That's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about the podcast, Fieldwork, a sustainable agriculture podcast, and their upcoming series about the unique farming culture of Washington County, Iowa. Now, we're going to meet one of the people who helped to shape that culture. Jim Freer was the Iowa State University Extension Director for Washington County for 32 years. He is retired now, but he was a pioneer in no-till farming methods and the use of cover crops, and he cultivated a progressive farming community in southeastern Iowa. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Jim.
Hi there. It's good to hear from you, Charity.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. And I want to go back in time. And, you know, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, of course, is still doing a lot of work around the state. But back when you first started working as an extension director for Washington County, there were extension directors in every single state. For people who don't really understand that role, can you tell me just a little bit about what you were supposed to be doing?
Well, my job was working in the area of agriculture and more or less community development, that sort of thing. But it was really heavy on agriculture. Derry County had a director, and we had contacts with area specialists and state specialists. So we planned programs for farmers that we felt were needed, and they requested information about, and we utilized the resources of Iowa State University and brought them to Washington County.
You started working in Washington County in 1960, right?
Yes.
And when you were starting off there and making connections with farmers, what was your impression of Washington County at the time in the farming community?
Well, I was raised on a farm, and I had a lot of interest in farming, and I like to get out and get acquainted with the farmers. When I heard of somebody doing something a little different, I contacted them and a lot of times went out to the farm, maybe took a few slides, And if we had a topic or a meeting on that, on some topic that related to that in the wintertime, I would use those slides or maybe have the farmer come in and share his experiences. I enjoyed meeting people. We had people that were leaders in the agriculture community, and that was one thing that I was impressed with, tremendous agricultural leadership here.
And when you were starting out in 1960, I listened to the episode of Fieldwork that you were on, and the impression that I get is you maybe are kind of a questioner by nature, somebody who doesn't necessarily think that the fact that we've always done something this way is a reason for continuing to do it that way. Am I reading you right, Jim?
Well, I wrote an article in 1965 in the annual report for the Soil Conservation District here that was published in the newspaper that maybe tillage practices were need to be examined, and because we had a lot of erosion on side hills, and we had in some years we had dust bowl type things in the spring if it was dry and they had fall tilled and had fine soil on the surface. So we were concerned about things like that. It changed over the years, of course, but that's my recognition at that time.
All right. So and that was pretty revolutionary to be asking that question at that time. I grew up in Blackhawk County in the 1980s. We moved there when I was 6 years old in 1981. And I remember, I mean, fall tilling was the status quo in 1981. And I remember how the ditches by springtime would be full of mud because all of that soil had run off the fields. And I mean, that was just standard practice still into the 80s.
Yes, it was. You'd have some extreme storms that would really wash down the waterways and wash out gullies into fields. And farmers didn't like that. And so soil conservation was working real hard to promote terraces and contouring and grass waterways and things like that. And we held meetings with the soil conservation people and ASC people promoting that back in the 60s and 70s.
So obviously it took a long time for this to catch on in the state. And I do remember when we stopped seeing people doing fall tilling. But, of course, everybody was still doing spring tilling at that time, or it felt like everybody was. But here you were in the 1960s saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't be tilling at all?
Well, really, we were looking for ways to get a crop planted and get a good stand. Of course, every farmer wants to get it the best yield he possibly could. But the first farmers who started no-till were in 1978 or 79. I've heard about it. I went out to their farms. I took pictures, and they became the initial emphasis for sharing the success or what they did to make it work as we plan programs in the next years ahead.
For people who don't farm, I think maybe it's hard to understand the risk factor involved in trying out any new practice. And you had farmers who were really willing to take on that risk and to be experimental. Of course, we know that Iowa State University has test farms all over the state where they test out practices like that and people research it. But these were farmers who were running a business, who were making a living, willing to at least use some of their acres to try some new things?
That's exactly right. And there were new technologies that had to be fine-tuned to make it really work. The old equipment for planting didn't work because you had to get the trash out of the way to plant a no-till. You had to have loose friable soil to put the seed in where you'd get good seed to soil contact. So they had to redesign corn planters and how they applied the fertilizer and everything, but to get good stands. And the second thing was to control the weeds that came up. Tillage always, just before planting, always disking and so on, so would kill early germinating weeds. Well, you didn't do this in no-till. In fact, some of our first no-tillers actually did it in sod, like last year's hay crop, where alfalfa or clover and broom grass and marjoram grass were growing. And those, you had to have a different type of planter to open the furrow, and they used waffle colders, we called them. They were 2-inch wide, wavy colder that tended to cut a track where the seed was going to be planted. And it was necessary to get that done, developed, so that you got good seed to soil contact. And so the ag engineers had to design equipment to brush the residue, the old corn stalks, out of the way so it didn't interfere with the germination and so forth.
What do you think made Washington County and the surrounding counties to some extent as well, because you had people coming to your events from surrounding counties too, but Washington County, as this series points out, has at several points in the past few years had the most acreage of cover crops planted with government help in the state. And it's not the biggest farming county. It's not, I don't know, what is it? What is it that created this environment where people were willing to take risks and try new things to conserve soil?
Well, it wasn't all conserving soil. It had a lot to do with that, but it had a lot to do with saving time. Earlier, they required a number of trips over the field with different implements, and with no-till, you just cut out all kinds of trips over the field, disking and stalk shredding and plowing and that sort of thing. So it saved time as well as soil erosion. And on the fields where we didn't have a major runoff, the flat fields, those fields adopted very well to planting corn into corn residue as well as in the soybean residue, which actually was very little on the surface compared to corn stalks. They saw that they could control weeds with an early cover crop, and it was before the concerns that are now being talked about, the concern of water contamination that's coming off of fields that's containing fertilizer or chemicals. And there's great government concern about that affecting the environment. So the no-till or in the cover crop thing was not even in the vocabulary when I retired in 1993. And so that's all come along since I've been retired. But these farmers are wanting to help preserve the quality of the environment. And there, of course, is some encouragement from government funding sources to encourage some of these practices.
That leads me to another important question. There are a lot of environmental benefits to no-till and to cover crops. But for a practice to really catch on in agriculture, do you think that it has to also help a farmer be more productive and more profitable?
Well, yes, it does. The farmer doesn't want to use practices that, or have to be forced to use practices that are going to cut back to potential yield or profit on a field or on a farm. And they want to maximize the income potential. And as they started using no-till, they found that they weren't sacrificing any yield. They were getting good yields, and they were saving time. They could plant twice as many acres, and there was a lot of people that wanted to get into farming, and the opportunities were being absorbed by neighboring farmers who were already farming, and it made it a little more difficult for someone to begin.
What do you think is on the horizon for agricultural practices? I mean, we've seen so much change since 1960 in so many ways, and we could spend 4 or 5 hours talking about some of the many, many ways that we've seen change. But we know so much more now about soil loss. We know so much more about the dangers of runoff. But of course, farmers are still trying to make a living, and they don't want to donate to these causes, even though a lot of farmers do want to be good stewards of the land. What direction are we headed in? What do you think we'll see?
Well, I think we're not going to go away from the need for concern of the environment, because there are reasons for, you know, what's happening down in the Gulf and so forth. And it's part of its agriculture, part of its industry. As far as my appearance looking ahead, a lot of concern and a lot of the guys that are on cover crop are looking at the improvement of the structure of the soil, which is remarkable in its changes. But the soils are different in the different parts of the country, and that you need to have the right combination of proper weather and timing and soil conditions, rainfall, and so forth, to make things work. And some years they'll work better than others. Some years they just don't work at all.
Cover crops are something that we know quite a lot about now. You know, we've had a whole lot of research done on cover crops and the many different kinds. You see a lot of cover crops in Washington County, but you drive to other parts of the state where cover crops would work, and you don't see them. What do you think is holding us back from embracing something that seems to have so many benefits?
Well, I really don't know. We had farmers that were well respected who did the practice and were successful, and the neighbors saw the results. I was a very skeptical person the first time I went into Dennis Berger's fields up by Wellman and saw him planting corn into ryegrass that was, I don't know how tall it was. It was a foot tall or better. And I thought, wow, that's never going to be able to germinate in that.
But it did.
They killed the crop with a herbicide, the cover crop, and those fields, by harvest time, you wouldn't even know there was a residue on the surface. They all decomposed and was mulch on the surface. And farmers see that and are impressed with it. I don't know whether they're just not enough leaders doing the practices in other parts of the state, but our farmers learned from farmers here. Most of what I've been saying here or talking about here, it was an extension. I wrote a lot of articles. Took a lot of pictures. I tried to get some features in the paper every once in a while, but and the twilight meetings and the tillage chairs all helped. But it was farmer to farmer that really was the thing that promoted our no-till and now our cover crop situation.
Sounds like we need a lot more of that.
Yeah, those were visionary people, and they were willing to do it.
Jim Freer of Washington County, Iowa. He was the Iowa State University Extension Director for Washington County for 32 years. He has been retired for some time now, but he was a pioneer in no-till farming methods and the use of cover crops. You can hear more from Jim on the Fieldwork episode, Twilight in Washington County, and Fieldwork will continue to explore the farming culture of Washington County and sustainable agriculture as the year goes on. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Each day on River to River, we focus on the news, issues, and events that shape our state. We aim to go beyond the headlines, giving listeners access to state legislators, congressmen, and policymakers, and allowing you to discuss the issues and offer ideas and solve problems as well. Join us on River to River, weekdays at noon on Iowa Public Radio.